Denver right now.
I mean, not that I'm overly fond of Detroit Airport, but it's definitely better than otherwise. You know the LPSB guys?
Yeah, Jim McCullough.
Yeah,
he's just really involved in our, well, bug, I say. It's actually it's just a user space because it predates Linux space. It was like a user
I feel like I'm going to the doctor with all these probes hooked up to me.
They are.
Yeah.
A little irregular heart rhythm there.
Yeah. I'm on. Okay, so I'm Greg Smith. I work for Treviso. Treviso makes a streaming database add-on that embeds inside of Postgres as well as some software that builds on top of it. So I work for them mostly doing customer side of product support and trying to get our software ready for the outside world. A good chunk of that involves helping customers set their systems up. So they want advice on, well, what hardware should I buy? What's going to work well? How should I test to make sure it's doing the right thing? That sort of thing. So it gives me a lot of time to play around with benchmarking to figure out what's going on. My position is that basically every time you get a new piece of hardware in, you should benchmark it. Why is that? Well, the first thing is that a lot of times the really interesting benchmarks tests, the one that kind of tell you really fundamental things about what your server's doing, you can't run them anymore once the server goes into production and is going somewhere. So if you don't collect that data as soon as you get the server in, you may never have an opportunity to get it again. And what will end up happening in the future? Oh, the server's not working well. What could be wrong with it? Well, you can't take the server down to try to do diagnostics like that. So if you collect the data right up front, you get that. Another reason is that software is really complicated. You got lots of layers to stuff going on. Once you actually get to where you're only looking at the high-level stuff, if you're only running application benchmarks or something like that, it's really hard to separate out what's the hardware doing and what's the software doing on the whole thing. So if you don't trust your underlying hardware before you even get started, you're caught with finger-pointing, developers yelling at administrators and people who bought the hardware and vendors. The whole thing's messy. If you at least have confidence, okay, my disks are working right, my CPU is working right, all that's working well, it really cuts down on the tree of what you have to troubleshoot when things go wrong. The other thing is that if you realize you need to upgrade the server, you really need to know what it is that's good or bad in the existing server so you know what to upgrade. You know, you don't want to go and do what a lot of people do, which is, oh, well, my disks are slow, so I'll go upgrade and add some random piece of equipment that makes the disk faster, only to discover, oh, wait, that didn't really do what I wanted it to. And that goes along with the final piece here, which is that, you know, vendors and the salespeople that are selling you computer products, you can't trust them. You know, they'll say, well, all you have to do to get rid of all your problems with your direct attached disks is, well, you know, switch over to a SAN or network attached storage or something like that. These are all lies. None of those things actually work without putting some real thought into how you're going to lay those things out, how you're actually going to use them. And in a lot of cases, disks that are attached directly to the system are just plain faster than ones that are attached via some other mechanism, even if it's something fast like a fiber channel, and especially if it's something that could be a lot slower like iSCSI if it's not set up correctly. So the kind of approach that I've taken is I kind of think of this as systematic benchmarking you do on everything you get. It starts with memory in the server, because there's a surprising number of ways that can get misconfigured nowadays. So it's good to know that your stuff's set up correctly. Then I move forward to CPU tests, because if the memory stuff isn't right, your CPU tests will be wrong too. So you really need to do it in that order. Next, I do kind of low-level disk tests on everything, work my way through that. And then you want to at least do some simple database-oriented tests on things that are kind of focused on low-level things that correlate well with hardware operations. And then only after you've kind of verified all those things work correctly should you be moving on to testing your application. So we're not really going to talk too much about the top two pieces in this stack. That talks mostly about the bottom three, because those are the ones that are they can be a little bit tricky sometimes. So there are a bunch of pieces of software available to test how fast your memory is. Some of them don't work quite like you expect. This is the set that I end up using. Memtest 86 Plus is the industry standard tool if you've got PC hardware for figuring out how fast is your memory working, is it doing the right thing. And I'll show some examples of using that. It's an old DOS program, but a lot of days the easiest way to find it is Ubuntu and some other Linux distributions and rescue disks and whatnot. Bundle a copy of it as one of the options when you boot off of the CD. So that's usually where you can find a copy in any place that's moderately Linux oriented. If you're running a Windows system instead, the free software that I found to work the best is Sandra, which was actually a pretty neat tool. It'll let you go in and benchmark things like memory and CPU and stuff like that, and they ship with a database of all sorts of other people's results. So you can compare them and say, well, look, I've got this particular type of memory, and I look in the database they provided, and typically people are getting this many megabits per second out of it. I'm only getting half of that. There's probably something wrong. That's the sort of thing you can end up doing with tools like this. Under systems that can compile Unix code, which includes Linux, there's a program called Sysbench that is actually what I find the most useful thing to ever come out of MySQL. It's a low-level benchmarking program that they put together to try to validate that hardware is working correctly. I'd say it's moderately tricky to get running correctly. So some of the examples I'll go through will show what I actually run and what works for me, because there are a lot of dead ends that you run the test, you think it's going to give you something, but it doesn't actually give useful results. Another thing that a lot of people have latched upon independently of me, and I did a lot of work with this myself, is under Linux, there's a program called HDPARM that you can run, and it will do two types of tests. It'll test very quickly how fast your drives are going when they don't have a cache active, and they'll also test how fast they are when you're actually caching stuff that's in RAM. Now, for the most part, that's actually correlates very well with your memory speed. If your memory's slow, your cache disk reads will be slow, and this is part of why another reason why it's important to kind of try to nail this stuff down first. The problem is that HDPARM results are very architecture and kernel specific. I've actually had a full 2-to-1 difference in results just by changing what version of the Linux kernel I was using, for example. So the only context that I'll use and what's nice about HDPARM is you can typically run it on a relatively idle server. You don't have to take it down like you might for some of these other things. HDPARM can be just the simple cached read test in HDPARM can be useful, but only if you've got the exact same software running on each of the systems you're trying to compare with it. You know, you've got in Linux world, you've got the same Linux kernel, you've got 32 versus 64 bits, it's the same everywhere around. It can be useful for relative kind of comparisons like that, but the absolute numbers really vary a lot depending on what version of all the software involved you've got. So I don't really like using it, but it seems like it should work, so a lot of people try it out. Yep.
Have you tried LMmesh? It should give you a similar result to Memtest 86. You don't need to take the
server. Yeah, I have, and the last time I tried it, I wasn't really happy with that. There's also another program called Bandwidth that's out there that does a similar sort of thing. The Sysbench test that I'm going to show an example of does basically the same thing that LMbench does. So the results are very comparable, and as you'll see, a bunch of the other tests that I've got in here use Sysbench for various things. So I it's probably possible to get LMbench to work, but because it's very tightly focused and I don't find it as useful as some of these other things, I haven't really investigated it heavily. So let's talk about Memtest 86. Here's a sample of what it looks like when you run it. It does two really useful things. One is the number that's interesting here is the memory number, which is the fourth one down on here. So in this example, we're actually getting 2.4 gigabytes per second, and that's a read number. And it's kind of neat, actually, to see how fast stuff is when it's in the CPU cache versus, you know, the level 2 cache in there and versus the regular memory in there. You really get a feel for, wow, stuff in the cache executes a lot faster when you're working on it. The other thing that's really interesting about Memtest is that as long as you've got a version that's been updated since the hardware that you've got was released, it will usually do a good job of telling you what the underlying RAM is and how it's configured. So in this example, it's correctly detecting that we're using DDR400 RAM, which runs at a clock of 200 megahertz and runs in dual channel, which means that pairs of the memory chips are kind of linked together, striped across to improve the throughput. That's why the 200 jumps to 400. So if you start this up and you've got any kind of reasonable server system nowadays and it tells you that you're running in single channel mode instead, there's probably something wrong. So this shouldn't be a problem if your vendor's doing a good job on things, but like I said, you can't ever trust your vendor. You can only trust your own tests. So here's an example of some results from a couple of these different programs. Just to give you an idea how the numbers tend to compare. I seem to have lost my example. So there's an example slide that doesn't seem to be here anymore about how to run Sysbench to do this. The specific Sysbench command, and I'll fix this in the slides that get uploaded to the website. The specific Sysbench command that I found useful is the write one. The read Sysbench thing gives completely cached results. It doesn't seem to correlate well with the actual RAM speeds. There's a couple of interesting things you could note from this. One is that results do scale pretty well in between the speed of the RAM correlating with the Memtest results and, for the ones that I've got them, the Sysbench results. So this is showing us whether or not it does what you expect it to or not. The other thing that's kind of interesting, if you actually crunch the numbers on this thing, is that you'll see going from DDR2-667 to DDR2-800, that's actually a 20% improvement in the speed of the whole thing, but the memory test results you get out of it, it actually jumps 25%. So that's kind of odd. The reason for that is that in the AMD and Intel CPUs that everybody's using nowadays, you could pretty much put in whatever combination of these things you want, but the CPU and the motherboard chipset have frequencies that they run at, and you need to have integer multipliers for some of these things. And what can end up happening if you have a bad combination where the clock of the CPU and the clock that it's trying to run the RAM at, it can't get to an integer multiplier, it'll have to round something down, and usually it's the memory speed that suffers from that. So in this case, we're running a 2.4 gigahertz CPU. When you've got DDR800, which is running at 400 megahertz, it's a nice even 8-to-1 multiplier on everything. It's all nice and smooth. The reason that Memtest result is slower than just the RAM decrease in that case is because you can't easily divide 333 megahertz, which is what the DDR2-667 is running, into 2400. So it actually clocks the RAM down to 300 megahertz instead of 333 in order to get all the integer multipliers that it needs. So this stuff might seem like trivia, but you know, a 5% difference in how fast the memory in your system runs is pretty significant. And if you're speccing a server out and you're picking, well, what hardware goes into there, you might have a drop-down box that says, well, you know, what processor do you want and what memory do you want in the whole thing. You really should stop and learn enough about how the multipliers fit together to make sure that the combination that you're doing is going to result in integer multipliers and that the RAM is going to be running at the maximum speed it's capable of. What else can slow memory down? As I said before, if you're running memory and it's only running in single channel mode instead of dual channel, it'll be cut in half. Typically, that happens because you put the RAM in the wrong slots. On a typical PC motherboard, there'll be, you know, if it's got four slots, there'll be two of them that are marked or color-coded or something like that that are a pair. If you put two sticks of memory in, you have to put them in those two slots. If you put one in each of the pairs, they'll both run in single-channel mode instead. So that's typically what causes that. Another possibility is memory reports back how fast it should run to the BIOS at boot time with this mechanism called the SPID, SPD. What it does is the motherboard kind of queries the RAM and it says, okay, how fast can you run, and you know, what are your timing numbers for how many cycles I have to do various things. Sometimes the SPID information on the RAM is not read correctly by the motherboard, and what you end up needing to do is go adjust either the voltage or the timing information in the motherboard BIOS setup to match what your RAM is really capable of. So that's a little thing that can cause problems here. As I mentioned before, bad RAM CPU multiplier combinations can drop things down. The other thing that I can't really overstate is there absolutely is a difference between good and bad quality RAM. The last time I did something, I was building a system for my home, and I picked a couple of different pieces of RAM, all from Kingston, all with exactly the same ratings. You know, you look at the spec sheet, it was 1 gigabyte, 2 gigabyte, and 4 gigabyte modules. If you looked at the specs, these would be exactly the same. There was actually a 30% performance difference between the 1 gigabyte ones and the 4 gigabyte ones, even though the specs were exactly the same on the two modules. Similarly, I then picked a different one of the larger modules from another vendor that had slightly better clocks, and I got another 20% faster on top of that. So these RAM issues, a lot of times if you're reading reviews and stuff like that, they kind of report fairly small differences for these things. Those tests tend to be very like-to-like things. The difference between good and bad quality stuff can actually be pretty substantial in PC hardware nowadays. So once you've kind of sorted out your memory's working correctly, you can move on to testing what's happening with the CPU. Now, the actual speed of the individual CPUs in a Postgres server is pretty important, because when you're executing a query, individual queries are only executing on a single CPU. It's not threaded to spread those across multiple ones for a single client. And as a result, if you're doing something that's a single process trying to do a bunch of work, which can often be the case, that thing is going to be limited by how fast that one CPU can run, no matter how many CPUs are actually in the box. What are the contexts in which you can actually run into the CPU bottleneck? Well, if you're running a query and it's not actually reading the stuff from disk, it's already sitting inside of Postgres' shared buffer cache, or it's inside of the operating system cache. Those are the kind of circumstances where if you're running a query against the data, you can easily discover it's running as fast as the CPU can run, and that's kind of the limit on the whole thing. Again, it's really intertwined with memory, though. You do have to be careful. You might discover that upgrading the CPU without upgrading the associated memory with it may not actually give you as much of a gain you were hoping for if it turns out you're actually bottlenecked on memory access for this stuff. Another thing to be aware of is that copy, the usual way people end up bulk loading stuff into the database, is known to be pretty slow as far as how much CPU it uses to load records in. So if you're loading a bunch of records in, you can easily find that the bottleneck on that is not the disk, but it's how fast the single CPU that's running the copy can kind of parse the information that's coming in and translate it into how it's going to be stored in the database. CPU tests, we find a similar set of suspects in here. Running under Windows, the Sandra software, again, has a great database to let you compare against other CPUs. Sysbench has a CPU test that works okay. Another thing you can do to test your CPU is you can use the generate series command in Postgres to do something CPU-oriented that's perhaps stressed by the workload that you're doing, and see how fast it goes. I'll show some examples of that later. Another thing, and this is actually what I find myself doing the most for CPU tests, is you can run PGBench on a database that's small enough to fit in RAM, and that will get you into the context I was describing before, where you're limited by how fast the CPU can execute the queries because there's no real disk access involved. What's neat about using PGBench is you can use it to see how fast single CPUs are, and you can increase the client count to see how fast each of your CPUs are and how fast they run if you saturate all of them. The PGBench client has some limitations in this area, but it's sense enough, for example, that I've been able to find regressions in the Linux kernel in between releases just by, again, systematic benchmarking. I benchmark everything I come across. I got a system and suddenly I realized there was a large regression against what I was used to seeing on that hardware, went back and come to find there's like this very obscure kernel scheduler change that impacted the results. Yep.
When you're saying CPU, and forgive me if I missed this, are you including cores in that? Are CPUs being treated as individual cores on a CPU?
Right. When I'm saying CPU, I'm talking about individual cores, and tests like PGBench end up using multiple cores, but there's a lot of things in Postgres that the speed of the core, it's of a single core, ends up being the gating factor for stuff you do because a lot of processes in Postgres will only run on a single core at a time.
You mentioned that you might end up buying better CPU and get stuck on your memory. Is there a way to actually know what your bottleneck is?
It's kind of tricky to do. What I try to be able to do whenever possible is try varying one of those things independently of the other and see if the change correlates. For example, if you've got a server and you believe it's bottlenecked on CPU, but maybe it's bottlenecked on memory, what you can do sometimes is go into the BIOS and throttle down the CPU or the memory to a lower speed, and then try running your benchmark again. And that's one way you can try to ferret out which is it in that case. If you lower the RAM speed to clock it down to something lower and the benchmark doesn't really change, you may have actually just proved that this is really CPU bound rather than memory bound, and the other way around as well. If it clearly seems to correlate with the memory speed and the CPU speed doesn't seem to have as big of a difference. It's very hard to separate these two, but that's an example of some techniques you can use to try to sort it out. The other example is to just try to get a sample of slower or faster RAM and drop it in the server and see what happens. That can help as well. So here's an example of the Sysbench CPU results. What it does is it just computes some number of prime numbers with a simple program and reports how many seconds it took to do it. So, because I'm using Sysbench for a couple of tests, this ends up being the easiest one I have available to just run. And this correlates pretty well with the overall frequency of the CPU that's running. This is an example of running. Yep.
Can I ask you a question about that previous slide?
Sure.
That seems to be speeding up.
Right. So this is how many seconds it takes to compute some number of primes. So the faster the CPU is, the less time it will take to do it.
That part I understand, but going from 2.4 gigahertz to 3 gigahertz more than doubled the speed of it.
Right. So that suggests, and this is why I recommend benchmarking this stuff, that even at the same clock speed, that newer CPU is substantially more efficient as far as how much work it gets done per capita of time. You know, at this point, the frequency, you can have, you know, Intel's famous for releasing CPUs that are exactly the same clock or even a slower clock than the previous generation of CPUs, but nonetheless are much faster in actual real work.
That's very odd.
That's the world we're in. That's why you have to benchmark everything. Trust no one. here's an example of what I was talking about with running PGBench. PGBench, you can create a small database and see how fast it runs to get an idea of how many selects per second you can run. The interesting part of the graph for testing your CPU is the left side of this, which is the area where your CPU bound in the whole thing. The right side of this is clearly the situation where you've switched over to being disk bound instead. And I got a bunch of stuff about PG Bench and another presentation going over minutiae here. But the real thing to walk away with is that you can look at this and go, well, if I've got a real tiny database, this particular server, which has got four cores in it, can execute a little over 20,000 really small queries a second. And as soon as it's got a little bit more data to chew on, it seems to flatline around 18,000 or so. So that's the number. Now we've got a Postgres number to kind of tie the other CPU results to as far as how many transactions per second you can get out of it. And as you increase the clients, if you were to just run this thing with only one client instead, you'd see 1/4 of that result because you'd only be using one core. And you kind of see it scale up from there. And I'll show you a better example of that in a bit. So what makes CPUs slow? Slow memory can impact all this stuff. That's why, again, I suggest checking that out first. The most common reason I see for the CPUs running ridiculously slow is power management. A lot of CPUs start nowadays with power management turned on and optimized for something other than performance. In Linux, the usual way you spot this is if you look at proc CPU info, you'll discover that the frequency that the CPU is running at is 1,000 megahertz. If you've got a faster processor, you see 1,000 megahertz in the CPU info, you've got power management running and you're probably not getting what the server's capable of. There's a thing called the CPU frequency governor that you end up changing to fix this problem in that context. And there's another, the default profile is kind of a mixed one. The performance one is the one that'll get you optimal results at the cost of increased power, of course. So, disks. I quantify disks in four ways. I kind of see them as, you know, four axes in a very complicated graph. The first thing is how fast can you do sequential reads and writes off the disk. Sequential writes in Postgres tend to correlate with how well the server can execute insert and copy commands. Again, a lot there are some circumstances where you can actually get CPU bound in those cases, so it's actually pretty hard to hit the potential sequential write of your disk. Using Postgres. Typically, there'll be some random component to that, especially because of things like checkpoints and whatnot that can break up your sequential writes and switch them over to more random ones. Sequential reads, you can get close to the speed that your disk will read at by running something that does a sequential scan of a table. You know, typically select star from it will go through, and those numbers correlate pretty well with what the underlying disk hardware sequential read speed is. The number of seeks that your hardware can do correlates very well with when you're selecting something using an index, or pretty much any time you're updating something, there's likely to be some seeking around on the database going on. Especially if you have not separated the write-ahead logs from the other parts of the disk. Anytime you update or insert something, you're going to have to seek. There's also another parameter that people tend not to think about as much as these other three, but is just as important, and that's how fast your server can actually process commits. Now, what's a commit in this context? The way Postgres works, when you write something out to the disk, it first writes it to a write-ahead log that kind of stores, well, this is what I'm going to do to the database. It then does that operation to the database and then marks that that thing in the write-ahead log has now been applied. If something happens in the middle of that, there's enough information stored to roll back the partially committed thing. Now, hard drives have caches in them, and you can end up with multiple layers of caches even in hardware. Your typical SATA drive nowadays is going to have somewhere between 8 megabytes and 32 megabytes of write cache in it. What you need to understand about that is that the write cache that's in the drives, those aren't really safe. Postgres expects that when it writes something, it calls a system call that on Unix platforms translates into fsync is the actual low-level operation that the call translates into. What fsync does is it says, I've written some data here. and I want to wait until that data is actually physically on disk, not just in a write cache somewhere. The problem with that is that drive manufacturers have realized that in order to get good performance out of disks, you kind of need to cheat and ignore a lot of these requests and say, well, sure, it's on disk, no problem, and it's not. So the reality of it is that a hard drive will only be able to commit based on how fast it spins. If you've got something that's doing a commit, follow a commit which implies an fsync, and you do that over and over again in a single client, that's going to execute and commit something every time the disk spins. So if you take the rotations per minute and divide it by 60 to get rotations per second, that's your commit number. So for a typical 7,200 RPM drive that's kind of middle of the road right now, that's 120 commits a second. That's it. That's the speed of light as far as disk drives are concerned. You cannot have a single thing commit more than 120 operations per second and confirm that they're actually on the physical disk afterwards. So there's two things to be aware of then. The first is that there is this limit, and if you seem like you're getting more commits than that, something is caching writes. And if you cache writes in Postgres such that Postgres writes something, sends it in fsync to flush it to real disk, and the drive lies about that, you can end up with database corruption. Because the way that transactions are kind of confirmed in the database, if you get that fsync and it doesn't actually happen, you can end up with mismatched data in the write-ahead logs in the main chunk of the database. And if you get a server crash in that situation, you can be in serious trouble. The usual kind of paranoid way to deal with this is if you've got a new server, while you're doing benchmarking and all this other stuff on it, you write something that does a lot of commits, you know, something that's doing a bunch of small inserts is a good way to trigger this. And get the thing cruising along and yank the power right out of the wall for it. Do that 10 times. If you don't see any corruption anywhere, your server's probably okay. It's shocking how easy it is to corrupt the data if there is a write cache that does not flush properly when you hit it with an fsync.
How does the file system fit into this? Does it make a difference if there's journaling or...?
Nope. The file system kind of passes the fsync right through to the underlying disk when you do this sort of thing. You know, the file system policies affect if you're writing things into the cache normally, the file system can affect, you know, how the blocks actually get written out to disk. The design of the Postgres write-ahead log kind of presumes that the underlying file system may or may not be doing the right thing, and it tries to protect against the typical errors that can get done in there. But the worst case is the file system, if you've configured it wrong to not send fsyncs through, which can happen under combinations nowadays, you can run into a problem like this. What I normally end up doing is actually confirming, you know, in the real world, if I know the disk spins this fast and I'm doing commits to it, I measure what's that commit rate, and if it seems too high, I start looking for caches that need to get turned off for the database to be reliable. Yep. Right, so I was going to get into this in a minute. We'll bring all this up. So what's the simplest test for sequential read and write speed for disks? If you've got a Unix system or even a Windows system that you've installed Cygwin on, you can use DD. It's a nice standard industry tool. In order to get any kind of useful results out of DD, you need to do at least twice as much transfers as the amount of RAM in your server to keep all the stuff from being just cached instead. The numbers you get are not going to exactly reflect the rate at which your disk runs, but it's a good approximation for typical write speeds. And the way this works is you do the write first, which creates a giant file, and then you read that thing back again. if at all possible, if you can try to either reboot or clear file system caches in between these two steps, you'll get more accurate results out of that. One thing that's kind of interesting to do while you're waiting for this thing to run anyway, it'll probably take a couple of minutes, is to run monitoring tools like VMstat and IOStat, and that does two things for you. If you look at VMstat's block in and block out, those numbers should match up with how many megabytes per second you're getting at that particular instance, or that instant in time. And that's nice because while you're sitting there waiting for this thing to go, you can actually see how fast it's running before the final results get out, just to get an idea if things are working right or not. The other thing that's really good for is you can get a feel for how much CPU usage is required to actually read or write to this disk at this point. And some of the more complicated tests, if you start bottlenecking that the CPU that's doing the test becomes the limiting factor on things, you may end up needing to do more complicated tests that involve multiple CPUs in order to sort that out. Bonnie++ is the simplest to use standard tool that pretty much everyone's familiar with for doing tests. It does a bunch of things that are really not important nowadays, like it'll write character at a time rather than block at a time. It's not interesting for databases. It's not interesting for most applications nowadays. It'll also do a bunch of tests for how fast you can create files. Those are interesting if you're doing file system stuff, but again, not really interesting for database use, and the defaults tend to not really give you good results for those anyway. Running Bonnie, it will automatically size the file to be twice as big as the amount of RAM in your system, so it takes care of that part for you. You can make it bigger if you want to. And there's a neat little tool you should be aware of, the output from Bonnie. It'll give you a comma-separated series of values as one of the ways that it outputs, in addition to some nicely formatted text. If you take that comma-separated stuff and you pipe it through this program that's bond CVS to HTML, which you'll probably have to make executable first for some reason. I don't know why they haven't fixed that yet. The result of that will actually spit out an HTML page that looks kind of neat that you can stare at too. And then those tend to be nice if you're working on a bunch of systems at once. You can kind of edit the HTML to get the tables to line up and then compare systems more easily with that. Alternately, you can just import the CSV files into spreadsheet software or something like that to analyze them. In addition to the sequential block read and write numbers, which are the most useful to from Bonnie, it also reports a seeks number. Now, it's important to understand what that's actually doing, and a lot of people are not really aware of what that means. What it actually does is it starts up three processes at once. It does 8,000 random seeks, and 10% of the time after it does the seek to read the block, it turns around and writes it back again. So it's kind of an odd sort of test. People kind of compare Bonnie++ seek numbers because it's the same test everywhere, but if you're trying to write your own random read tests, you need to be aware that the Bonnie one is running with three clients at once and doing some writes as well in that mix. Bonnie also comes with a really interesting program called ZCAV. ZCAV stands for Zoned Constant Angular Velocity. The concept here is that hard drives have speeds that vary quite a bit based on what part of the disk you're in. Typically, the outside part of the disk, which is the logical beginning of the disk, is much faster than the inside part, simply because if you're spinning the disk at a constant speed and you're on the outside of it, more bits are passing by the read and write head per capita of time if you're on the outside, simply because it's bigger at that point. Bonnie++, the scaling on it was all wrong. If you've got terabyte drives or hundreds of megabytes per second worth of rates on the earlier versions, the first one that really seemed to work for me was 1.03e, which is the current one right now. There's also the usual thing you do with these results is run them through GNUplot or some other software that you're comfortable with for charting. GNUplot's handy simply because if you're on a Unix system, it's usually relatively easy to get and it's easy to script. They provide some sample results and some scripts and whatnot. On the Bonnie site, if you dig down a little bit, but I found that the samples that are out there are kind of broken. They don't really match the current version of it or whatnot. So this right here is the actual GNU plot script that worked for me for this. The default one, the position and the label stuff was incorrect. So this would just be in the PDF if you look through this later, so you can borrow this example in order to compare a couple things. This is my laptop, which has got a 7200 RPM disk. This demonstrates what I was just saying. The stuff at the part at the bottom is kind of the logical offset from the beginning of the drive. At the beginning, this drive's getting 55 or so megabytes per second when it's reading like this. By the time it gets to the end, it's barely over 30. So there's almost a 2-to-1 difference between how fast the fast sections of the drive are and how fast the slow sections of the drive are. This is really critical to understand, especially if you're doing file system comparisons, because what some people do will say, well, I want to compare two file systems. So I'll take half the disk and I'll create it with the one file system, then I'll take the other half of the disk and create it with the other file system, and then I'll run comparisons against the two. Well, I can tell you how that's going to work out. Unless there's a massive difference between the file systems, the difference in speed between the inner part of the disk and the outer part of the disk is going to dwarf whatever differences you're doing. If you want to do file system comparisons, you got to use exactly the same section of the disk because of this. Here's an example of a more complicated setup. The one I showed you on the last slide is the green one at the bottom. The top is actually three disks in a Linux software RAID. So if you're running a RAID disk, you should, if possible, measure the individual disks and then measure the RAID after you've assembled it and confirm. If you're putting a RAID and you put three disks in it, you should get close to, in the same general area, three times whatever the underlying throughput is. If you put up three disks in a RAID and it's only one and a half times as fast, there's probably something wrong with the RAID controller that you're using or something about the system that you've put together that needs to be addressed. So Zcav is good for that because it separates out this what section of the disk you are problem, which you can't necessarily see if you just look at an average from some section. Sysbench, again, it's possible to use it to construct your own tests to do seeks or other random combinations like this. This somewhat complicated thing is the example that I use for doing seeks per second. You start out, tell it how many you want to run simultaneously, how many gigabytes you want it to run it over, and what you want to do. In this case, it's just random read. It's important to recognize that whenever you're doing any kind of sequential or any kind of random read or write test, the actual part of the disk and how wide of a section of the disk you're using is really important. There's actually a technique that people use called short stroking. The idea is that if you've got a disk like, if you've got this disk right here and you wanted it to be as fast as possible, you might just decide to only use the first 30 or 40 gigabytes of it. Put a file system there, ignore the rest of it altogether, and your average speed is going to be a lot faster. Similarly, whenever you're seeking between two sections of the disk, if the maximum possible space that you're seeking over is constrained a bunch, you know, seeks are relatively linear based on how far across the disk the read head has to travel in order to read that data. If, you know, the disk is this big, but you're only seeking over a 10 gigabyte section that's this big, you're going to get much, much better results out of that than if you were seeking across the whole thing. So tests that create files typically are going to create a file of some size. You need to recognize that random read results should always be referenced relative to how big of a section you're doing the random read over. Yep?
On the slide that showed the performance of the RAID array,
yep.
Can you comment on the those points that are kind of scattered?
Yeah, those are probably something ongoing on the system at that point, despite my attempts to keep it as clean as possible. What the normal practice for running this thing like this is to run the test multiple times and kind of average the results out, and Bonnie will do that. You can tell it, we'll run this, you know, 3-5 times or something like that. And if they show up in only one of the three tests, well, that was probably something ongoing in the background. Yep.
Assuming when you set up a file system, if you wanted to do this short stroking, or for instance, partition a disk so that I know that this is my fast partition and this is my slow partition because they're at different points of the disk. Do I do that by creating a partition from sector 0 to sector whatever, and I know that that's the middle of the disk, the different OSs and different F-disks?
Every example I'm aware of nowadays, the logical beginning is the fast part. And, you know, drive manufacturers do that because if you're doing a benchmark with a fresh drive and you write data to it, you want that to be on the fastest part of the drive. And most file systems start, you know, at the beginning and then move forward as you go. This is one of the things that impacts why computers tend to get slower after they've been used for a while, because you've got more and more files that are on the slow part of the disk as you fill the thing up. This is actually good to know as well when you're trying to compare, like, small SAS disks to giant ones that are running SATA or something. Sometimes if you take an SATA disk and you only use the really fast part of it, you can still end up with more storage than an SAS disk. And you'll notice that the performance gap narrows quite a bit by doing that. Here's an example of what Sysbench random read results look like. In this case, I got 128 seeks per second over the 10 gigabytes. And if you multiply that out by what the block size I was using was, you get a number it also reports for you, which is how many megabytes per second that represents. And again, like I was saying, you need to consider how big the disk is and what section of it you're using in order to properly interpret results like this. Bonnie and DD are pretty simple tests. I recommend people use them because you'll find gross errors with it. If you actually really want to do serious performance work, you should use either the experimental version of Bonnie, which includes the ability to run multiple CPUs at once and reports additional information, other good stuff like that. And then the more complicated tools in this area that are worth looking at are IOZone and FIO. The main reason I don't really cover them here is because they're a lot more complicated to use and get right. Bonnie tends to be run it and you get results and you don't have to argue with anyone about whether those results are accurate or not. If you're on Windows, there's a program called HDTune that's free, and you get a better one if you buy it. And it does it measures pretty much everything's here and produces graphs like the one I was just showing you. The only thing it doesn't really do is break out commit rate in the same way that you can with some of the Sysbench tests. What can make your disk slow? If you've got a RAID array and you've set it up such that it doesn't really map well to the underlying hardware because it's like odd logical disk, that can slow things down. Buggy drivers can slow things down. Not having enough bandwidth available via, you know, your fiber channel network or whatever interface you've got for disks that are not direct can slow things down. As I said, if you've got a really fast RAID array, you can bottleneck a single CPU before you can actually saturate the thing. So you need to be aware of that. What storage vendors like to harass you about are things like how you've aligned the file system with the underlying stripe and, you know, fun stuff like that. Mostly because then people get confused and wander away without actually demanding their money back for junk that they sold. That I haven't found to be as big of a difference as the vendors like you to think it is. You should still get reasonable sequential read and write speeds, even if that's not quite right. If your writes are faster than your reads, which can happen sometimes, that's probably the read-ahead settings are not quite right for the thing is the common cause. And the two links at the bottom go to some presentations by a couple people who are in this room at the moment talking about some troubleshooting stuff in this area and what the sort of things that can cause bad behavior. This is the simple thing I use for fsync as far as measuring commit rate. That'll get you a number out of there that tells you how fast you can commit stuff to disk. You can also run pgbench and just tell it to insert records and not do anything else. That'll let you measure commit rate. There's a module in Postgres called contrib test fsync. Sometimes it gives you good results. Sometimes they're a little bit odd. They don't match the stuff. I keep meaning to submit a patch to improve that, but I haven't gotten to it yet. Here's a sample laptop disk, the one that's in here right now. The kind of interesting number, when you talk to storage vendors about this stuff, they all talk in terms of IOs per second or IOPS. Now, what an I/O is from the storage vendor's perspective is the combination of seeking to somewhere on the disk, waiting until the disk heads have aligned up, and then doing a read or write at that situation. So it seems kind of odd, but you can actually direct, you can compute that number directly given the specifications for the disk. So in this case, this thing takes an average of 11 milliseconds to seek, and 4.17 milliseconds is the standard time. That's half of a rotation for a 7200 RPM disk. And that transfer rate kind of matches the best of the speeds we saw in the Zcab output before. So the way you compute IOs per second from this is to go in and figure out the rotational latency if they don't give it to you. And the IOs per second is just the inverse of the latency time plus the average seek within a track time. So if we break that computation out for the previous one, you get that single disk is capable of 69.5 IOs per second. So when you're talking with vendors and they talk about this, you can think of an IO per second as a single random read somewhere. And therefore, if you've got something that's bound by random reads or write, that's very interesting, and that's kind of the key number that you want to deal with. But if you've got something that's slow because it's doing sequential reads and writes, which can be the case in a lot of these times, and your vendor starts harassing you about how many IOs per second you do, you have to just not engage in that discussion with them. You have to point out, I don't care about seek performance in IOs per second. I'm concerned about sequential reads and writes, which don't have the seek overhead and everything else. You know, why are these things slow? And what's great about using real simple tests like DD and Bonnie is that if you have an array and you run one of those things and the results come back miserable, it's very hard for your vendor to dispute that you did the wrong thing in your test. And that's part of why I like those better than the more complicated things. Here's some quick links that you can find in the presentation for more detail about I/O per second and how storage vendors tend to talk about it. You're going to have to go on the performance when it gets posted to the site. I'm running low on time here. So here's a couple of sample disk results. These are from the laptop disk I've been doing things on before. And the three-disk RAID array I've got other results from. So the main thing I want to point out on this result is that the three-disk array has got a safe write cache on it. And in Postgres context, that means a write cache that's got a battery backing to it. If you've got a battery-backed write cache, that can safely cache writes, and it'll f-sync relatively instantly, and that's safe. The numbers for my laptop, the big number there is how many I get with the write cache turned on, and then the tiny number, 58 per second, is what I get when I turn off the write cache. Only that second number still gives you performance that is useful for Postgres. If you don't have that write cache turned off on that type of disk, you're not running in a safe environment. The only way to get good commit rate out of a server is to have a disk controller that's got a battery-backed write cache on it. There's no real way around that. Or if you've got a lot of clients committing at the same time, those can get kind of bunched up so that each commit commits from a lot of people, and you can kind of get above that fundamental how fast the disk spins rate. Here, Generate Series is a neat tool within Postgres you can use to run tests. Timing will give you timing on everything you run. If you run this, this is a very simple CPU test. How fast can my CPU sum these things? Takes a second or so on my laptop to run. Similarly, you can use Generate Series to generate chunks of test data for tables and then either do explains or reads or writes or stuff like that. So it's real handy to know about Generate Series to build your own kind of one-off test to test particular behavior you're interested in. This is linked to another set of things. This is an article by David Wheeler, did some interesting work showing how to use Generate Series to measure function call overhead, and I thought that was a really nice intro to building kind of custom benchmarks. If you've got a chunk of code and you want to try to figure out, well, if I make changes to it, does it get slower or faster? And sometimes you can end up needing to do work like that to try to sort out hardware problems. PGBench is our final topic here. PGBench actually has a little scripting language that it runs things in. This is what it looks like. So when you're doing that select-only test I was showing examples from before, it looks at this scale, which it detects as far as how many records are in the database. It looks that up at runtime. It then generates a random number between one and that scale and then just selects that one record out of there. So this the fact that there's this little programming language says that you can do interesting things with PGBench beyond just running the tests that come with it. You can write your own custom tests for it. This right here is what the standard... This is an example of a custom test that just does a database insert. So this inserts stuff into the database but doesn't do any of the other parts of the whole thing. This is not one of the options that's built into PGBench, but if you know how these tests are written, you can run this yourself. Doing small inserts into a small table like this, it will actually measure the commit rate for you and kind of give you a way to double-check the numbers that you're getting from the fsync tests. This is what the standard PGBench test looks like. It does a couple of updates, a select, an insert. It's a very complicated combination of things. And I got some slides here you can kind of stare at later, I guess, for how many transactions per second you get based on the size of the database that you're working on, the scaling factor thing. And then PGBench also gives you different results depending on how many clients you've got. This is the thing I was talking about before. If you've only got a single client going, you're only using one CPU, you only get a fraction of what you get if you've got a multi-core machine and you're running multiple clients in parallel. You have this fancy diagram, which I don't have time to talk about, but it looks pretty cool, right? This is another example of a custom PGBench thing. This creates a little table and run something that just inserts some number of bytes into that table. And I've got a tool that I'm working on publishing to the world at large. It should finally get it done this week now that I'm finished with this thing, that lets you say, well, let me run this thing at a bunch of different scales and kind of automates running those tests and getting you the results back from them. So here's something that only take you a couple of minutes to write, and if you run that, you can kind of see interesting results like, gee, at what point does the number of clients I've got inserting impact things? Is there a difference between whether I'm inserting into the scale in this case is how big the record is? Does that change things? So I'm just trying to write an example of how you can write a custom PGBench routines that do something very different from what the standard ones do and kind of use that underlying test harness to do neat things. So there's my summary. Again, trust no one. Don't start on benchmarking application stuff till you've confirmed your existing hardware. Vendors are at the top of your list of people not to trust. And whenever possible, you want to understand how terms like IOPS and other stuff like that work and have run through those enough so that when your vendor tells you, oh, you know, starts asking you questions about IOs per second or other stuff like that, you know what you're talking about, and you can divert that over to the language that they're from the language they're using to what you're concerned about. And the final thing, and Josh Berkus really emphasizes a lot in his presentation, if at all possible, don't buy anything unless you have the option of returning it if it doesn't perform well, because a lot of things, even from very well-respected vendors, perform shockingly badly, and there's nothing you can do about it if you've already bought it and you've got no way to return it. And vendors are a lot more motivated to fix stuff if they know that it's coming back if they don't help you with your problem. So that's it. I don't think I have too much time for questions here because I'm running a little slow. But we'll shoot while I do. Do we know who's in here next? Okay, you want to start setting up while I field questions? Oh, are there?
I thought these two were back to back.
I wasn't sure about it. What? Yeah. So I don't think we really have that time. So anyway, I can field questions while we switch hardware out here for a couple of minutes. What? You had a question? I don't claim you should trust me. What I'm doing is how to test the stuff yourself. The only thing you can trust is that if you learn how things work, you can test them yourself. Nothing else will help you, and certainly don't believe anything I told you. you know, what you're talking about is kind of software level testing. You're trying to test how software runs. That it can be kind of interesting that the kind of focus of this thing that's done here was on low-level hardware tasks. You know, I could do a whole other presentation just on the subject of that stuff that you're talking about, and I don't actually do like as much of that as some other people do. I'm not very much of an application developer guy. I do a lot of systems testing setup and whatnot.
Because
so.
When you do, we have a write a role special system to do asynchronous clients.
Yeah. No, I mean, that stuff's vitally important, but that's kind of a layer above this stuff that I was talking about.
Yeah, both,
you really should be some hardware set stuff before you start doing that, just so you're not caught by something you didn't expect.
Is it possible to download this presentation?
Right, so I'm not sure exactly when it's going to get put on the site, but what Dan will do is all the presentation PDFs go onto the PGCon website. So if you go to where it's got information about this presentation, sometime either at or shortly after the end of the conference, all the slides will be available there.
Very interesting. I wish I could repeat some of the steps.
Yeah, well, you know, you try it yourself.
Okay.
That's why I tried to include all the commands, actually.
What will do the room? The other one does the recording. It's kind of cumbersome, but they are smaller mics, at least.
I've been traveling nonstop the last few weeks, so I'm kind of unorganized.
Hi, I'm Steve Singer. I'm going to give a talk on OpenStreetMap and Postgres. My day job, I work for a consulting company and managed hosting company, but by night, I run around with a GPS and try to make maps. I also do bulk import projects. So what I'm going to talk about first, I'm going to talk about what is a free map and different ways maps can be free and might not be free. And then I'm going to go talk a bit about how OpenStreetMap works, both in terms of the infrastructure and how data is collected and put in and maps are drawn. And then I'm going to talk a bit about how to use the data, since you can download all the data from the website and use it with Postgres. So what is OpenStreetMap? We're primarily a project to build a free, editable map of the world. We're anything that you think might want to be you have on a map, whether it be roads, lakes, or rivers, buildings. We're interested in getting all of that into our map. We're looking on building a worldwide map, and this is an editable map. Anything on the map should be editable in the wiki fashion. Sort of by anyone who signs up for a user account. Our data is all currently licensed under the Creative Commons ShareAlike license, and that might change to something called the Open Database License once the lawyers decide work the details out. But both of these are ShareAlike GPL-style licenses for data. So is your map free? You might ask why use OpenStreetMap over Google Maps or MapQuest or one of the other mapping providers. And what you want to ask is, any of these different maps give you some freedoms, and some of them don't give you other freedoms. So you want to evaluate which freedoms you're getting and not getting and decide what you're happy with. So the first type of freedom with a map I like to talk about is, are you free to see the map? And this is freedom. This free to see, you can have the freedom to see it. And the best example is a map that you're not free to see. The military has maps. Militaries love making maps. A lot of them might be stamped top secret. what's on that map, I don't really know because I can't see it. These are maps you're not even free to see, let alone edit or buy. You can also be free to see a map, but it might be not free as in zero cost. You go to the bookstore and you buy an atlas. You have to pay for it. Sort of in, you know, some places you can get a tourist map. They'll just give it to you. That type of map you're free to see, get, and do some things with. Other maps you have to pay for, pay $1 or $10 to look at your map. Another type of freedom is, are you free to give the map away? If you have the map, can you give it to someone else? And with paper maps, usually the answer is yes. But there's other ways of giving a map away than just handing off a paper map. What you might be doing is, you know, you might want to photocopy or duplicate the map, sort of publish the map and give it to all your friends. You might want to include the map on a brochure you're making. These are all freedoms that you might have with some maps, but you might not have with other maps. And you would want to evaluate this as you're picking your map. Also, are you free to distribute the map? In particular, I'm talking about things like an embedded device. You're building a navigation system for a car or a GPS unit. Do you have to? Can you include the map on this device that you might be selling, or you might not be, or you might be giving away, without running into afoul of the licensing conditions or terms of service of your mapping source? If you've ever tried pricing some of the costs for maps from to distribute from TeleAtlas or Navtech, which are the two of the major map providers, to distribute on an embedded device, it's a lot of money, and you have to be talking of fairly large volumes for this to be economical. Another type of freedom is, are you free to derive from the map? Are you free to take the map data and add to it? This here is a screenshot of a project called Topa OSM. When I refer to OSM, I'm referring to OpenStreetMap. What OpenStreetMap does not include as part of the map, elevation data, contour lines. As mostly for a data size, and that's data most people probably don't want to be editing. So the project's decided not to include that as part of a map. But there are sources, other free sources of elevation data. NASA, I believe, had a shuttle mission once that mapped most of the world with high-resolution radar. And you can get this data and use it under a fairly permissive license. So what this project here has done is they've taken the OSM data, they've taken the elevation data, and I believe they've taken a couple of other data sources. This picture here is, I believe, of downtown Boston or Boston Harbor. And they've taken all of these different data sources, combined them into one database, and are rendering maps that have more in it than the OSM maps. The other type of freedom you might or might not have with a map is, are you free to change the style? When you build a map, you have to decide what it is you want to include on the map and what level of importance you want to give to different features. This is all within sizing of the map, sizing of different features, the color scheme you use, and depending on what point you're trying to get it across with the map, you're going to make different decisions. Are you free to change those decisions to produce a map that's good for a different purpose? One of the companies that works with a lot of in the OSM space is called CloudMade. They do a lot. They host a lot of OpenStreetMap data and contribute to the project. One of their services on their website is they've come up with a whole bunch of different map styles. This is one of them, and then you can select a different style off their web page and see it's, you know, a different style of the map, different color scheme. They have another one here, you know, they sort of more of a tourist style map. You have pictures of museums for museums. Depending on what you want to do with the map, a different style might be appropriate. And you have to ask, is your mapping provider allowing you to change or tailor your mapping style for what you're trying to do? Another type of freedom is, are you free to edit the map? If a road is not on the map or is in the wrong place, can you change the map? If something's spelled wrong, can you correct that? Most of the mapping projects out there, or at least many of the mapping companies out there, do not allow you to change the map. With OpenStreetMap, we allow anyone who, you know, it takes 5 minutes to sign up for an account. You just have to provide an email address. You can then go and change the map. What I have here is a picture of one of the OpenStreetMap editors. It's written in Java, called JOSM. It's a Java program. This here is the University of Ottawa area. Those buildings are the campus buildings, I believe. We're just north of the green area. And you can, the editor allows you to add things to the map, move the position of items, and change places. Why is it not going to the next slide? There. So how did OpenStreetMap get started? It was founded by a guy called Steve Coast in 2004. In North America, in the U.S., and to a lesser extent in Canada, there's a tradition that a lot of the data the governments produce are released under the public domain. In the U.S., there's a fairly large geographic data set done by the Census Bureau called TIGER that they've released under the public domain, and Americans have, you know, access to free maps of their neighborhoods. I'll talk a bit about the quality of those later, but them and many other countries have free maps. Some countries don't release their data for free. In the UK, there's a branch of the government called the Ordnance Survey. They go out, and their job is to make very detailed, careful maps of everything in the country. And if you want to access some of these detailed maps the Ordnance Survey makes, they are more than happy to negotiate licensing terms and a fee for whatever need you have with the maps. So Steve said, well, if I go and make a really good map of my neighborhood, and you go and make a really good map of your neighborhood, and we both release it for everyone else to use and change and do what they want with, then they are able to, then we'd all be better off. So it's based on the idea of crowdsourcing. What we have here is a graph. The purple line is the number of OpenStreetMap registered users over time, and the pink line is the number of GPS traces in the database. So where are we? There's a little over, we're around 120,000 registered users at the moment. Only about 30% of those actually have edited something on the map. And then some of those are regular contributors, and some of those are not regular contributors. The idea of OpenStreetMap is you get a lot of people in working, seeing the data, working with the data, contributing. The crowd will correct the mistakes. The crowd will make it better. That's sort of the idea of crowdsourcing that is sort of core to the OpenStreetMap philosophy. So how does it work? One way it might work is you go out with the GPS, turn on the logging features, and collect a whole bunch of data. It's kind of hard to see these thin points here, but those are the GPS traces that have been imported into the program, where the GPS records, you know, every second where it was at that particular second. And so if you know where it is when you were walking, you know what was there as you were walking by with your GPS collecting this data. You can then import it into the program, and there's tools to draw points and lines on top of those GPS traces. So up there, you know, I've drawn a line, a sort of a couple of points to form a line, or two lines actually, over the GPS data. And then you can add tags.